Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I'm delighted to have this particular guest back today on Church and Culture. Dana Gioia is known around the world, especially in the United States, as a poet. He is the former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, where he served in a very distinguished way. Dana Gioia is presently the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture at the University of Southern California, not a bad place to be. Dana is a Californian. He came from Stanford University, and he got his M.A. in comparative literature at Harvard. We'll forgive him for that. He has 5 full-length collections of poetry, and his latest collection, entitled 99 Poems New and Selected, was the occasion of his last appearance on Church and Culture. Dana Gioia, welcome to the show again.
I'm glad to be back. You're not rid of me, I guess.
No, I can't be rid of you. You've got too many good things to talk about, and you and I sometimes exchange emails about interesting things, and one thing we got to talking about was a new book on poetry entitled The Hatred of Poetry by a poet named Ben Lerner. Now, before we get into discussing this book, which I think I don't agree with a lot of the things in the book, but it's a marvelous tool for thinking about poetry, I think. Who is Ben Lerner, and why did he write this book?
Well, you know, Ben Lerner is, one of the most interesting younger American writers. He publishes both poetry and fiction. I've been a big fan of his, a bigger fan of his fiction than his poetry, but he's one of these sort of, triple threat kind of writers. He does poetry, he does fiction, and he now is doing essays. I had read his first novel, which I actually recommend to people, called Leaving the Atocha Station. It's about a young kind of Ivy League kid who gets a writing fellowship to spend a year in Spain, to write this, work. And the guy just basically messes around. He drinks,
Oh, he didn't. Oh, boy, I can remember my first sabbatical. I'm guilty as charged.
He's always mostly unsuccessfully chasing girls. He's depressed a lot. He does, in fact, almost everything but write.
Right.
And it struck me as it's beautifully written.
As is this book.
And it strikes me as, and he's very critical. I mean, clearly part of the book is autobiographical, and there's a kind of I would call it a healthy self-contempt. I mean, I know that sounds very Catholic. you look at your own life and you wish were doing a better job of it. But I thought it was a really brilliant first novel. He then wrote a second novel, which is, the number of which is, the title of which is just, a number 1004 as in on a digital clock, which has to be one of the cleverest, most complicated books I've ever read. But it's immensely readable. It's fun, although it did fill me a bit with a bit of despair about the younger generation. I mean, everybody's, is absorbed in their private mania. But anyway, he's written these 2 highly regarded novels, which I think the first is better. And then, you know, he's published a couple of books of poetry, and then a few months ago, you know, he published this book, The Hatred of Poetry. I should tell the listeners that it's not really, you know,
yes,
a book physically, but it really is just a single essay. It takes about 45 minutes to read.
Which is all the better for it.
Yeah. So I think it's a form that I like. Actually, I've begun publishing in a similar way, which I would call a monograph, you know, where you just write a longish essay and, you know, and people can sit down and read it, in an hour.
And you can actually reread parts of it, as I did this book.
Yeah.
And it's a great tool, as I said, a tool for thinking about poetry. Now, you made the comment that this is the book that, at least on the, I think, the Amazon list of books about poetry, finally topped yours after how many years?
Well, it's, you know, there's, you know, male writers, I guess, are very competitive. I'm actually, to me, it's more of a game. But 25 years ago, I published an essay called Can Poetry Matter? It became a kind of international scandal or, you know, sort of self, you know.
Scandal to success.
Scandal or achievement, you know.
Yeah.
Depending, a lot of people argued over it. But the book is, you know, the essay, which then became a book, is really quite famous. And I've been waiting. One thing, you know, if you write a big book on a subject, somebody else is going to come and be the book that's most talked about. But in my case, I kept waiting and waiting, and there wasn't really a book that, you know, or an essay that achieved, you know, that level of attention. But Lerner has. Lerner has left me in the dust, and I'm.
Oh, well, hardly the dust.
I'm happy.
I don't think he'll last 25 years.
You know, but it's good. It's good to see another discussion capture the public's attention. But it is a curious book.
It is very curious.
And a lot of the thing, the ideas and emotions in it are really worth discussing. So it'll be fun to talk to you about.
Let me give you just a few off the top reflections. I'm not a poet, and I'm not really a literary critic. I hope I'm a good reader, and I've read widely in poetry and fiction, as you know. There's a lot of implied mysticism in this book. A lot of implied mysticism of the sort we call apophatic, the via negativa, the affirmation of God by denying certain attributes. There is a search, call it a search for the absolute, which he assigns to poetry, but poetry cannot reach it. And then he then turns that around and goes back to Plato's argument that the poets should be in some way repressed or thrown completely out of his ideal republic. And he seems to go back and forth between the Platonic question, but really the question that seems to interest him the most is more a deeper kind of theological or philosophical question. Do you see any of that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's a complicated book to explain to someone who hasn't read it, even though the book itself is very readable. I would say that there are three stories that are being told simultaneously. You know, I'll start with the basic one, because, you know, Lerner's a novelist, and so he's telling stories.
Yes.
And the first one is just Ben Lerner as a nerdy student who ends up becoming a poet. And so it has things about his elementary school. It has about going to the dentist, who asks him what he does and is a poet. And anybody who's a poet knows how, this is very true, that if somebody asks you what you do and you say you're a poet, the person has no idea how to respond to that, we're so out of the ordinary that the people don't really know what to do. They kind of feel sorry for you if you say you're a poet. So he's got this personal story going on.
He beautifully weaves all kind of personal stories in and out. You know,
yeah,
like the
yeah.
time you went to the movies for the first time without his parents. And so
yeah.
On.
And so, you know, so it's really, so it's, and these are very funny. You know, they're,
yes.
they're very funny and very true, this kind of ramble, You know, so you sort of say, you know, it goes on. The second essay that goes on is the intellectual one. And that is a surprising one. So you got the narrative, you got the philosophical. And he's a Platonist. He takes Plato's notion that there is an ideal reality out there. This obviously becomes one of the animating Christian notions of the Renaissance, and lasts till this day. And what the poet does is somehow participate in, you know, what Plato would call the noumenon. You know, you see an ideal poem, and you try to put it into human words, and by definition, you will always fail.
You bring the noumenal to the phenomenal.
Yeah.
The non-perceptible to the perceptible.
You know, and so, yes, he talks about, you know, something that I've talked about, everybody talks about, which is, you know, Plato wants to get rid of the poets from his ideal republic, but that's not, you know, he's really on Plato's side, not socially, but philosophically. So you have this long, and I have to say it's the most elaborate Platonic argument, you know, I've seen any poet make since the generation, you know, like the Kathleen Raine, the Christian poets that are, you know, a generation older than me, were, you know, almost Platonists to a man and to a woman.
Dana, it might be pointed out that that's where Platonism actually went in the ancient world. It developed in Plotinus, in Pseudo-Dionysius, and others, into a via negativa.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, Lerner, I assume, why, I mean, Lerner is an agnostic, and...
You think he really is?
Well, but the interesting thing is that, you know, he defines poetry as a transcendent art that reaches for the divine. And so the whole discussion is, you know, and I think this is interesting. I mean, is shadowed by a divinity in which, you know, he doesn't believe and yet somehow senses.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's, and so you have, you know, you have, and so what he really has ended up with is a Renaissance Neoplatonic, you know, idea, you know, of poetry. It wouldn't be too different from somebody like Henry Vaughan.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, one of the metaphysical English poets, you know, all of whom, you know,
it comes out of this Topeka,
you know,
it comes out of this Topeka, Kansas / Brooklyn College / New York City intellectual kind of thought all mixed together.
Yeah. And so you've got that. Then there's the third book. So you've got the personal anecdotes. You've got this Neoplatonic examination of poetry as an art that reaches for a divine ideal. And the third book, and this is really what inspires the title, is the emotions of the book. The emotions of the book are at best elegiac. You know, longing for this art of poetry, which is, you know, at one point he says poetry is not difficult, it's impossible. And also this sadness at how poetry has shrunk in our culture. He, interestingly, and this is, I have to admire him, he takes on a couple of big poets and just says how bad their work is.
Right. He does. And he makes it stick.
And in fact, these poets are not very good. You know, they're hugely, you know, influential right now, but he basically goes after them. But so you have this book, you know, The Hatred of Poetry. So, and the notion is that, and at one point he says the hatred of poetry is internal in the art. That there's no way of being a poet seriously where you don't end up hating the craft because it's philosophically impossible, and on top of that, in our culture it's culturally marginalized. And so, you know, that second theme is something that I wrote about, but you know, I did not you know I mean, to me, if and this is probably why I'm an Aristotelian. Okay, you've got a perfect ideal. Anything you do is going to be an imperfect realization of this.
Yes.
This perfect idea. Okay, fine.
So what?
Make you responsible, you know?
That's just the way life is.
Yeah, and ultimately that's exactly where we're at the very end. I mean, because learners, you know, you have to at some point say, okay, it's impossible. You're always going to fail. But you've got Rilke, you've got Keats, you know, you've got Shakespeare. Some people have given us enough to compensate for the theoretical impossibility of the art itself. And so he comes to a kind of sensible conclusion, but it's a really interesting book.
It's a book that, you know, like I say, it really makes you think, especially someone like myself who hasn't thought deeply about the aesthetics of poetry in a while. I'm talking with Dana Gioia, who is one of our nation's most best-known poets, former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, latest book of poems, 99 Poems, New and Selected, came out this year. Dana, you must have related to some of the stories he talked about when poets meet ordinary people and they're asked what they do.
Well, yeah.
And they can you tell us how you related to that story?
The thing is that, I mean, you know, I'm at the moment I am poet laureate
of California.
California,
right?
And I've decided for my project as poet laureate, because you have almost no duties as a poet laureate. You're doing
now. Did Jerry Brown himself? Okay.
Yeah, Jerry Brown appointed me.
Wow.
So I think I'm the only literary person.
Well, I guess his Jesuit education kicked in.
Jerry Brown.
His Jesuit education kicked in for the good there.
Well, I think so. Well, you know, I think Brown is, I think Brown is a good governor for California. California is an essentially ungovernable state, and so, you know, and Jerry Brown is one of the few people who's ever figured out how to manage this beast, you know. He was trained in the Jesuit seminary, and.
At a time when they got good education.
Yeah, and that probably kicked in, in this. But anyway, you know, for my project, I'm going to try to visit all 58 counties. These are mostly rural, agricultural counties. And so I meet people who are outside the literary world. And there's two things I've discovered in terms of this project, you know, they don't surprise me, because one is, no matter where you go, there are intelligent people. They're
right.
Interested in ideas, they're interested in literature, and they show up for poetry.
Right.
You know, the librarians are astonished because they've never had a poetry. I was in the town of Colusa, California. The librarian there had never, you know, had a poetry reading under her many years of service. And so she was sort of surprised at how many people, you know, in Siskiyou County and Humboldt County and Del Norte County, you know, they're always, you know, the audiences are much bigger than they, and much livelier than they think. And so there's that. And I think
that must be very refreshing for you as a poet.
Well, it is, because, you know, to me, if the only audiences that exist for poetry are in creative writing departments,
right,
then I hate poetry too. I mean, I think that's actually, in a funny way, part of the dilemma of Ben Lerner, is that, you know, he's Midwestern Jewish, kind of medium-sized town intellectual, and now he's in New York. You know, it's kind of this cosmopolitan,
right.
And I think in some ways he's longing, you know, for his roots, you know, which is more of a mid-American.
Yeah.
But he doesn't believe that there's any audience there for him. This is the problem with all of us, is that, you know, I mean, I've gone to Stanford, Harvard, and Stanford again. You know, I've worked in New York, I've worked in Washington, D.C., and you get cut off. I'm a working class Latin Catholic kid, and you get cut off from your roots. And in my case, I came back to California. I'm living in, rural Northern California, you know, because I want to reconnect to my roots. But I think without that, you get lost up in this kind of empty cosmopolitanism. And so the first thing that I notice when I'm doing these readings is that there is an audience outside of the universities. I mean, I have people that are ranchers, you know, people that, you know, that, you know, work for public utilities. There's all these local poets, there's local painters, and there's that. And the second thing is that they all ask you questions, because what they share, and this is sort of interesting, I mean, I think this is, you know, this is something else that, you know, somebody should write an essay about, is that they love literature, they love art, they love culture, but they are bewildered by the official arts culture. You know, they're bewildered by the poems they read in magazines,
right,
you know, by the art they see praised. And so you start getting these questions. So, I mean, I've had literally, word for word, the same questions asked for me repeatedly. I mean, you're a poet, and one of the things they'll ask you is, what kind of poet? You know, you know, how do you answer that? So I usually say, well, I write, you know, and they say, what, and then they go, you know, and so you have to sort of come up with some answer for that. And
well, Dana, no one's better, in a better position to answer that question than you are. I mean, both as a poet and as former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, because that's what you did while you were in that chair. You tried to cultivate an appreciation for art, or meet the need for art in the general public.
Well, you know, I have an absolutely unadulterated belief in the power of art. And I think that's something that's fundamental to Catholics. I mean, we believe we
yes.
live in an incarnate, you know, world. We have both body and soul. We respond to creation. We respond to the physicality of the world. And that's why painting and sculpture and architecture and music and poetry speak to us in the fullness of our humanity. And when the church loses the arts as a way of speaking, of examining issues, of speaking to the world, then the church is crippled. And in fact, we live in a, you know, we have a Catholic church now that, if not crippled, is at least severely hobbled, you know.
Well, didn't Catholic art go off the rails along with the sort of officially praised art over the last 30 years?
It's very complicated. I mean, because, you know, you have, you've had, you know, great Catholic artists.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's even a few, you know, today, you know, but, you know, the part of it was the separation between the church and art. I mean, the church used to commission art and used to have very good taste in art. You know, part of it is the, you know, the culture's view of this, and we're, you know, a part of it is the artist's views of themselves. But, you know, we, as complicated as it is, we need to rebuild it. We need to, the church needs to recognize and champion its artists. And I think you have a whole generation of people, and, you know, like Lerner, who are longing for spiritual meaning, you know, in a world which seems busy and distracting. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Lerner is an extraordinarily intelligent. This is what I liked about his first novel. And once again, I'm not, you know, saying that Ben Lerner is going to, you know, come and seek, you know, solace in the Catholic Church. I just think that he's, you know, he's a representative of you know, really some of the more most intelligent.
Well, Judaism has its own very strong and old mystical traditions.
But I don't. I'm not even sure he's gonna. You know, he's gonna. You know, be dancing with the Hasidim. No, but he's a real intelligence. And so what he has, he flips back and forth between two modes. One is the deeply serious, spiritually hungry seeker, and the other one is the ironic commentator.
Yes. Yeah, self-consciously ironic. Yes.
Yeah, you know, the trouble with our culture is that, you know, the only healthy impulse we have left is irony. And irony is powerful, it's illuminating, but irony creates a distance, you know, creates a barrier.
Yes, and he constantly talks about presences, and he talks about the presences that are found through silence.
And silence is exactly what our culture will not give us.
Yeah.
you know, you
now. My question: we got 2 minutes left in this segment. Does poetry, in fact, aim to touch and to communicate the absolute or the transcendent?
It can, but poetry is not an art that has only one purpose.
Right.
You know, poetry is a special way of speaking and writing that elicits and rewards a special way of hearing and reading. And so it's a language, and you can say anything you want in that language. That being said, because poetry is so concise, expressive, and memorable, poetry becomes one of the really great media that we have to explore the absolute.
And by the way, at the towards the end of our show, I'd like for you to read a poem of yours, of your choosing, from your latest volume.
Okay.
So we can get that. And I want to remind our audience that we're talking about a 2016 book, small book, really a monograph, by Ben Lerner, called The Hatred of Poetry. And if you're interested in getting your mind in gear about aesthetics, poetics, and its connection to philosophy and religion, I strongly recommend this book. I marked it all the way through, and I'll say this, Dana, just before we pause for a break, about halfway through the book, I wrote down, this man is feeling the urge for the perfect happiness of God.
No, I don't disagree. The book is full of spiritual hunger and longing, you know, for transcendence.
So we'll be back to talk more about poetry and love it or hate it, about God or Satan, with poet Dana Gioia, who is the poet laureate of the state of California, among many other things. We'll be back just after this short break.
Celebrate those who choose a higher calling. Play in the Bishop's Golf Classic for seminary and education at Hawk Hollow and Eagle Eye in Lansing. Support the young men who choose to answer the Lord's call and become the next generation of priests serving your diocese. Get your foursome together and call 517-342-2503 to register to play on Michigan's premier courses. You'll help ensure the future of the Eucharist, the heart of the Catholic Church, as we tee up for seminary and education. Call 517-342-2503.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Are other people responsible for making your child behave? Short answer, an emphatic no. But I have 78 more seconds of commentary, so let me go on a bit. Parents will oftentimes tell me, you know, little Rutherford was really difficult in Sunday school. But, you know, I don't think that was his fault. I think the Sunday school teacher is kind of a weak disciplinarian. Or, Grandma can't really handle him. You know, if she was firmer, I think he'd be a lot better behaved for her. Or the teacher, he had a really bad week at school. But, you know, I think the teacher needs to set limits on him. All of these things would be nice. All of these things would be helpful. But the truth, the hard truth, our children need to behave for other people, whether or not those people can handle them. I do not want my child behaving well only because somebody can control him. I want him behaving well because that is the right thing to do. And it is not the Sunday school teachers. It is not grandma's. It is not the teacher's responsibility to make my son behave. It is mine. And if I find out that that boy did not treat those people with respect and follow their expectations, he will answer to Dad, because I am his primary teacher. They are not responsible for making him behave. It certainly is nice if they can, but if they can't, I will not make excuses for him. I must deal with him. I'm Dr. Ray.
Back with Dana Gioia, poet, critic, lecturer, and former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. In a little while, he's going to read a poem from his latest collection of poems called 99 Poems. Getting back to Ben Lerner's book, The Hatred of Poetry, explain to our listeners just what is meant by the Greek word poesis.
Well, you know, we think of poetic describing something that's abstract and insubstantial. Poesis means making, and so the poet was someone who made a song, made a dance, made an epic. And so, the emphasis, in poesis is on, the ability to create something. It was less about some, creative and inspired state of mind. And I think for this reason, people who talk about the arts generally use the word, poesis or poetics to describe all of artistic creation, making music, making, sculpture, making literature.
It seems to me, hasn't the word poesis over time gotten kind of sublimed into something much more than making?
Well, you mentioned, I didn't bring up Plotinus, but you did. there's this this great work in the late classical period that if you read, it contaminates you for a lifetime. Which is Plotinus's On the Sublime, which is simply one of the greatest things ever written about poetry. And what Plotinus talks about, or the author that we've, the mysterious author who we call Plotinus, the people argue whether he truly exists. Basically says there is a kind of poetry, there's a kind of experience, and you just think of it standing on the edge of a mountain, looking at the mists, think of Caspar, Friedrich David's, paintings, it's a dizzying experience of so much beauty and majesty that you can barely take it all in. It leaves you drunk and dizzy. And Plotinus says this is the greatest kind of art. This is the greatest kind of poetry. And he quotes a number of passages and people he thinks are sublime. I mean, for him, the most sublime poet is Homer. And especially Homer's descriptions of battle. I mean, the ancients universally preferred the Iliad to the Odyssey, just as we moderns prefer the Odyssey to the Iliad. And so this has become a kind of a vision by which, to a certain degree, I think we still do say that the best poetry, the greatest poetry, is the most sublime. And so it's, things like Yeats or Wordsworth or Eliot, and it tends to be where poetry longs for the infinite, intersects the divine, and begins to, in a sense, somehow describe the undescribable.
Poesis becomes a kind of making of a connection with the transcendent, and then expressing it, trying to express it through words.
Yeah, and so, and then in modernism, I would say that it goes one step further, which says, we no longer have to really make anything. It's the effect, that we're going after. And I think that, one of the poets that Lerner criticizes, and I think he's absolutely right, I think it's one of the people who, has created an infinite amount of confusion, is a guy named Charles Olson, worked for the post office, actually, and spent most of his life desperately trying to get appointed postmaster general. And he wrote this kind of avant-garde poetry, which is projective poetry, where you sort of put it all over the page, and it's supposed to create a field of energy, blah blah blah. I think it's just confused and misguided poetry.
Is he right when he says that it marked the beginning of post-war American poetry rejection? He says it's a rejection of what you see in T.S. Eliot, the rejection of totalizing ideologies.
Well, it's Charles Olson becomes, I think, one of the foundational texts for bad avant-garde poetry and bad academic poetry. It's where you have a theory of poetry, and so you pay so much attention to the theory of poetry that you don't pay attention to whether the poem itself is any good. You know, you could say it's a kind of misguided Platonism,
yeah.
Where you're so fascinated by the noumenon that you think you're reaching that you don't really critique your own phenomenon. That's a terribly philosophical way of saying it, but where you let the idea of the poem blind you to the actual practice of the poem.
Isn't that antithetical to the writing of the making of poetry altogether?
Well, I think it's antithetical to art. Art, you know, is about creating. I mean, once again, I go back to the original version of poesis. It's about making a thing which is fascinating and powerful and illuminating. It doesn't have to be sublime. It can be funny. It can be gripping, you know. I don't think Shakespeare's As You Like It, with the exception of a few passages, is sublime, but it is brilliantly and transformingly humane, you know, in its vision.
Saved his sublime speech for the end of Merchant of Venice.
Yeah, well, about the music of Circe. I mean, there's the little speech that the Duke gives in As You Like It. You know, are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? You know, that ends up with with really a Catholic vision. And this our life exempt from public haunt finds tongues in trees, books in running brooks, sermons in stones. And good in everything.
Love
you
that.
But, and that little moment, I guess, is sublime. But, you know, by and large, you know, there's art can be many things. You know, art can describe anything, you know, in existence. And some of those things are silly. Some of those things are magnificent. But anyway, it's I think what Ben Lerner is longing for, is Wordsworthian. I mean, Wordsworth is a poet who almost never, even though he champions ordinary language, you know, by the time he really gets going, he almost never condescends to being ordinary. You know, he's reaching for these great transfiguring moments of the divine. And, you know, Wordsworth is an interesting Christian poet. I mean, if you really read Wordsworth, you understand that he quite literally believed he was a prophet of God.
Now, this kind of approach to poetry would appeal to Lerner, would it not?
Oh, it would. And I think same thing with Rilke. I mean, Rilke lived. I mean, it's sort of funny. On one part of, you know, when Rilke gave a poetry reading, he appeared in evening dress. You know, there was a crystal, you know, vase with a single rose, and, you know, he spoke to the wealthiest people in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he lived in the castles of the wealthy when they were, you know, vacationing elsewhere. So Rilke is an absolute upper-class aesthete on one hand. But on the other hand, Rilke led his life as a kind of Catholic hermitic saint. You know, he spent most of his time alone. And after he wrote his great poems, the Duino Elegies and Sonnets to Orpheus, he then stopped writing altogether in German. He then, thereafter, only wrote poems in little minor poems in French that he knew were minor poems. And, he just led a contemplative life. A very strange thing, but these are the writers that I think fascinate, Lerner.
He
wishes on some hands that he could be one of these great mystical writers, whom he admires. And don't we all?
I want to ask you a follow-up question about Rilke. And I know it's off the subject a little bit, but I've always wondered about this. When I read Rilke in translation, unlike some other poets in translation, I always get the sense that I'm missing something that I would find if I was reading the original. I mean, missing something really substantial. Is that correct?
Well, to my taste, Rainer Maria Rilke is the greatest poet of the 20th century. I think he's probably, with Goethe, the greatest poet in the German language. I mean, he is a poet of sublime magnitude. When Rilke writes, especially in the later poetry, you feel as if he's taken the German language apart so that, you know, every echo and everything works in it. And in fact, he has rhymes. He rhymes words. That when you see the two words rhyme, you get this moment of metaphysical insight, this frisson of illumination. There's no way you could translate that. Because he's getting down into the very roots of a language, and that's precisely those elements which are untranslatable. That being said, you know, Rilke is so great that if your translation brings over 50% of Rilke, you know, he's still heads above, you know, almost every other poet writing.
Whose translation of Rilke should we be reading?
Well, here's the problem. The Duino elegies, because they are unrhymed, and they're in a kind of long elegiac line, which even Rilke is rather flexible with. The Duino elegies tend to translate really very well. There's a number. Stephen Spender's old translation, I think, is good. There's three or four translations that are good, so that poem comes across. The early poems tend to come across because they're, you know, while they're formal, you know, they tend to be a little less mystical. But the sonnets to Orpheus, I think, are almost untranslatable. You know, so, and you can't bring the rhymes over. People have tried, but, you know, you change the poem. So I don't know. I mean, you could. I think if maybe Al Poulin, Poulin, probably did it as well as anybody. The Stephen Mitchell translations are very, are very popular. I think they're very, you know, rather good. By all means, avoid any translation by Robert Bly, who's just god awful. For years, there was a woman who was married to the head of Norton. You know, H.D. Herder Norton, and they had they had the English language rights to Rilke, so she translated all of Rilke. So avoid Herder Norton's translations; they're the oldest ones.
Well, what kind of poet is Ben Lerner, and is he around 35? How old is he?
I'm not sure how. I would say he's late 30s, but I'm you know. Oh, it here says he was born in 1979, so we he's just shy of 40, yes, mm-hmm. Late 30s.
Is he a good poet?
I don't like his poetry as much as I like his prose, but, you know, once again, I probably haven't read it as carefully as I have his prose. His poems tend to be long, somewhat rapturous lines. They're very prose-y. He's trying to work everything into his poetry, but I haven't gone back, you know, and read the reread the poetry with the, you know, the attention that I brought to the prose. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, Lerner's done something. This is, you know, there's very few people today who can write intelligently, meaningfully, crucially about poetry in a way that the average intelligent reader can follow, if you know what I mean. I'm not saying, you know, to write for people that don't care about literature. You know, but there's a huge audience of people that read novels and history and theology and biography and don't read much poetry. And part of the reason is that there aren't people engaging them in a cultural conversation. And I think what you see in Hatred of Poetry is that Ben Lerner has found a way of engaging the attention and curiosity, I think, probably thousands of readers who you know, don't normally think of themselves as connected to poetry. And so, and I think it has enormous cultural vitality. I mean,
there's a little bit of populist, populist impulse behind what he writes.
Yeah, and it's, see, populism has become a dirty word in intellectual circles. They think populism means talking down to people, simplifying things, lying, in fact, you know, lying about some, you know, some truth, you know, that would appeal to people. I don't agree with that. I think the populist impulse is one of the major impulses in American culture, and it's a belief in democracy. It's a belief in the diversity and intelligence and range of the audience. And I think that, you know, whatever people thought of my article, Can Poetry Matter, they had to agree, because, you know, it generated more response than any article on any subject the Atlantic Monthly had ever run, that I had captured people's imagination, and it gave people a chance, in a sense, to reconnect with poetry, to talk about how poetry meant something to them. That's exactly what's happening with Ben Lerner's essay.
Do you have a poem from your collection that you could read that might illustrate some of the themes we're talking about in Lerner's book?
You know, I could... here is a very Catholic poem. It's, in fact, written in the form of Beatitudes, about, in a sense, the via negativa. It's about, in a sense, how stripping away things, stripping away the ego, you know, are, you know, the ways in which we reach the divine. It's called Prayer at Winter Solstice. Blessed is the road that keeps us homeless. Blessed is the mountain that blocks our way. Blessed are hunger and thirst, loneliness and all forms of desire. Blessed is the labor that exhausts us without end. Blessed are the night and the darkness that blinds us. Blessed is the cold that teaches us to feel. Blessed are the cat, the child, the cricket, and the crow. Blessed is the hawk devouring the hare. Blessed are the sinner and the saint who redeem each other. Blessed are the dead, calm in their perfection. Blessed is the pain that humbles us. Blessed is the distance that bars our joy. Blessed is this shortest day that makes us long for light. Blessed is the love that losing we discover.
I would just say that Ben Lerner would really like that poem, is my guess.
Well, you know, we'll see.
Because it delves into this issue of reaching toward that which is this presence that he talks about, by pushing aside or negating things that finite things that get in the way. You talk about homeless, blocks, hunger, thirst, loneliness, exhaustion, blinds, and the love and the love that you discover when you've lost it. That's all this via negativa that I see going in Lerner.
Prayer at Winter Solstice is a very Catholic kind of prayer. It's about what we need to give up in order to get what we need most.
Or even what we're made to give up, even against our will.
Yes, well, part of it is, you know, I mean, seeing reality. You know, I mean, that's, you know, when people say that, you know, what is beauty, Thomas Aquinas tells us, is seeing, in a sense, with humility. Humility is seeing things as they really are. Beauty is seeing the form and the meaning of things as they really are. So, you know, it's...
And taking pleasure in the singing.
Yes, and so, you know, so anyway, I'm
Yeah, that's, and that reminds me, you said earlier, I asked you if poetry was all about reaching toward the transcendent, and you responded, poetry does many things. And one thing that I sort of missed in Lerner is the idea of just taking simple pleasure in poetry.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's a
I'm sure he does, but
yeah, he's very funny, but you know, mm-hmm. he's, you know, like a lot of comedians, you know, he's in some ways governed by anxiety. And what the things that sometimes people put on that anxiety, but I think that Ben Lerner, you know, like somebody like Philip Larkin, is somebody who really is puzzled and hurt and tortured by things. You know, he still enjoys himself. He still, is full of energy and invention. But I mean, there's a depth of emotion in Lerner, which I think comes across in all of his writing.
Which I think actually draws it to our attention, and
yeah.
ergo this conversation about his book.
Yeah, and I'm going to go back and reread his poetry. I only know one of his three books. I think called I think it's called Lichtenberg Figures. He seems to be emerging as one of the major young writers of his
generation. Have you met him yet?
No, as chairman of the NEA, I met everybody, so.
Because they wanted money.
All I know is I could have had dinner with, you know, in a group with Ben Lerner, but I have not had the pleasure of really meeting him, you know, if I've met him at all. But I look
well, if you meet him for dinner, invite me, because I'd love to hear that conversation.
Okay, I shall.
In the few minutes we have left, what is in the future for Dana Gioia? You talked about this project as Poet Laureate of California. Now, is that going to take the form of a book of poems or what?
Well, no, I mean, we'll see. You know, the poems will come as poems come. I mean, for me, poetry is sort of involuntary. But I'm doing my public service, which is interesting to me. I'm going all over the state and giving these readings, giving talks. I'm starting to put together two books of essays, I think. One's going to be called Poetry is Enchantment, and the other is going to be called The Catholic Writer Today,
you
know, based on the essay that I published in mm-hmm. First Things. But I'm going to gather a number of other essays that I've written on Gerard Manley Hopkins, on John Donne, on Brother Antoninus, things like this. I'll put together those.
Would you have an essay on Rilke?
Well, you know, I don't.
I mean, as the 20th century's greatest poet.
Well, they have. You know, I've translated Rilke. I mean, but there are 1,000 essays I wish. The trouble is to write one of them well.
And so who do you think is the least appreciated modern poet of stature?
Oh, there's so many. There's a poet I think is a great poet called A.D. Hope. This great Australian poet.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him.
Fantastic poet.
Carcanet publishes him.
Yeah, and I think he's one of the best poets of the 20th century. No one in America reads him. But A.D. Hope. Think of hope, faith, and charity.
Did you ever run into C.H. Sisson?
No, he condemned me for a piece that I'm going to put in Catholic Writer Today, which was I wrote a piece on the Epistle to the Philippians, and which
he actually became a friend of mine.
Yeah, well, he's a very very interesting.
Yeah,
I think he and I should have liked one another.
You should have been natural affinities, elective affinities. Right.
For some
there.
Reason, something bugged him in this thing, and he somehow thought that I was saying that. A young poet was greater than the Bible, which was certainly nothing I said.
No.
I basically talked about how
misunderstood.
You know, I wrote this essay on the Philippians, and a very simple premise, which is, you know, they asked me to write this piece, and I said, well, here, I'm this, you know, poet at the end of the 20th century writing on Philippians that's been talked about by some of the greatest minds in Europe, you know, in the world for 2,000 years. What can I add? And I said, well, all I can say is, well, maybe there's things that as a poet I would notice about it that a philosopher wouldn't. And somehow he, you know, Sisson got the meme that I was rejecting all philosophy and theology.
Well, I think he spent a lot of his time fighting against the literary establishment. He just picked
I think Sisson, when he saw a young poet, when in doubt, figured he would just go for
exactly. Especially from California.
It didn't bother me at all. It didn't bother me at all. So I was, I'm always happy to be attacked.
Well, Dana, you haven't been attacked on this show, and once again, I want to thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture, and we look forward to these two books of essays as well as your next book of poems.
I look forward and, to having a next book.
Well, I know it's coming, and you're a gift to all of us, and we appreciate your being here and taking this time. And to all of you who are listening, hang around after this break. Got another interesting guest.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Ave Maria Radio is looking for someone who is dedicated to the station's Catholic mission and is also flexible in their time to work with us. If you like data entry and a willingness to learn billing and traffic, then you can help the apostolate thrive. Learn more about this part-time off-mic position by sending your resume to resumes at avemariaradio.net. That's resumes at avemariaradio.net.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Well, What's the Point series on marriage and the family concludes on our next edition of Christ is the Answer. Mary Gelpop, the Director of Evangelism and Catechesis at Our Lady of Good Counsel Parish, speaks on Our Late Holy Father's encyclical with the English title on the dignity and vocation of woman. Mrs. Delpop's talk title is The Dignity of Woman. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 6, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
I called a friend to check up on her. She had been going through a personal crisis, and I could tell when she answered the phone she had been crying. We talked for a while, and while on the phone, I was silently praying to God that He would give me the words He knew she needed to hear. I've been reciting that prayer for months, and almost every day I would come across a biblical quote or an inspirational saying that I would text to her or email to her. She said to me on the phone that day, "Do you know those quotes you're sending me are keeping me going? You always seem to text me exactly what I needed to hear at that moment." Our faith teaches us that we all have crosses to bear in life. In Psalms it reads, "Passing through the valley of weeping, you'll find pools of blessings. And when you're in the valley, if you'll stay in faith, knowing that God has something better, He'll take those tears and turn them into pools to refresh you." This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communication evangelist.
Sometimes life seems filled with competing demands as we try to serve our families while also helping those outside of our home. How can we find a balance? Stay tuned to today's Homeschool Heartbeat as author Ann Voskamp answers these questions.
Ann, in addition to blogging and writing books, you're also a full-time homeschooling mother. How do you find a balance between your service to your family and your service to others? And I'm going to ask you the question, but I know the answer anyway. Do they ever collide?
I think there's really three things about that balance, Mike. Number one, simplicity is never a matter of circumstances. Simplicity is a matter of focus. So in the midst of educating and parenting our children, we can't necessarily go ahead and make everything fit into neat, controllable, simple schedules. But the point is, simplicity is how do we keep our eyes fixed and focused on Christ no matter where we are. Number two, life isn't an emergency. Christ is in charge of every moment of the day. Nothing catches Him off guard. And number three, grace is the most amazing of all because, yes, Mike, parts of our lives do collide. We live in a broken world. And for the life of me, I can't.